as we begin Main Street on this Wednesday, it's time for our Philosophical Currents monthly discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life. Jack, how are you?
Oh, I'm happy to be here. The recent rainstorm made all of the grass green, and my mood is in a much better place than it's been for a while.
So it brought back life, so to speak?
Yes, very nice. Very nice, Greg.
So today we are going to pull a question right from the headlines, or maybe even from the Ice Age. I'm not sure. Should we bring back extinct species? Should we bring them back to life? From woolly mammoths to the dire wolves that, and I'm using that dire wolves in air quotes, that we've now seen. De-extinction raises fascinating ethical questions about science, nature, and our role in shaping the future. And even if Jack and I don't know a lot about the science behind all of this, there are those who are trying to do it. Question is, should we? And we'll dive into that. Jack, from a philosophical standpoint, what moral obligations, if any, do we have to species that have become extinct, and even species that humans help drive to extinction?
You know, this is a super interesting question, and there's a whole lot of threads that we can pull. We have to have a larger vision of what our responsibility is to the ecosystem as a whole, and what our responsibility is to the people and the future and all of that sort of thing. At the heart of this is a vision of our relationship between us and nature. And this is actually one of the places where people really disagree. Are we caretakers of nature? Is it our responsibility to care for it because it is in some sense helpless or has no agency? Or is nature just a collection of resources for us to exploit? The Abrahamic tradition, the Bible, suggests at some point the second, right after the fall, when Adam and Eve leave the Garden of Eden, God says to them, you know, this is all of yours to build off of and to use as your tools, but it will be through pain and labor and all of that sort of stuff. And that attitude led to mass destruction of wooded areas, horrible contamination of water, real sense that all we need is to use these things for our own benefit. And then other people came along and said, this is a path to destruction. It's a path of destruction for the whole world. It's a path of destruction for human beings. And they started looking not only at different philosophies of nature, but also different cultures and the way that they've dealt with nature and what it means to live alongside. So at the very heart, at the very first, at the beginning of the question, is a fundamental point of view that is going to help send us down the ethical path.
It seems to me now there's little, if any, regulation about what is happening, that a company is moving forward. We've seen pictures of what they say is a dire wolf. Who knows if it is or really isn't? Yet they're marching forward on their own, it seems, to do it. Is that an ethical thing to do?
This is also a huge fault line in the discussion, because law is inherently conservative. What law does is establish our reality based on the past. And I'll give you an example. 100, 150 years ago, a bunch of people in Grand Forks or Fargo or Bismarck decided this is how big a housing lot is going to be, right? This width, this length, this is what it means. This is how much of land you have to have for one house or two houses or what have you. That binds the decisions that I make. That tells me where I can purchase houses, how big of a lot it can be. So in a certain way, people 100, 150 years ago control my life. Science, however, happens really fast. And anytime there's a new discovery or a new chemical or anything like that, law often doesn't address the issue. This is one of the fundamental complexities with drug regulation, right? Someone comes up with a new synthetic drug, LSD-7 or something like that. It's not illegal yet. And people can use it until the legislation catches up. This is one of the issues we're having with the internet right now. There's a lot of stuff going on that the government, our older government officials, don't understand. Ethics doesn't have the same limitations because it's not necessarily a matter of legislation, it's not necessarily a matter of consent, but it is still slow in that it builds off of the past. So the question that we ask ourselves is, how is the new situation similar or analogous to how we've seen, to what we've seen so far? What can we extrapolate from the past that we can apply to the future? And so the first question ethicists are going to ask is, does this harm? Does this hurt people? Is this a force of good or a force of bad? And once we have a sense of that, then we can start asking subordinate questions that help us negotiate the details. We always have to ask, what have we learned from the past that we can work by analogy to our present situation?
You've brought forward a question in our discussions prior to our conversation right now. Should resources be exploited or utilized to bring back a woolly mammoth or that species that is almost extinct today, but we can work to save now? Have you thought more about that?
Well, so I want to take a step back, because when you posed this as the topic of conversation, I responded, I don't really know that much about it. And so what I wanted to do was spend a little time and talk about how philosophers approach a new topic. And the very first thing I did was contact my friend, because we have to figure out what the facts of the situation. We have to have a sense of the context, and we have to have a genuine sense of understanding. So I reached out to my best friend, Gail Sherman, who's a writer for Boing Boing, which is a major longstanding blog. And she's got the science and technology and cute animals beat. And we talked about the dire wolves and her position, and then I looked into it and agree with it, is that these are not dire wolves. That
what do you mean by that? Because we're being told they are.
Yes, it's spin, it's marketing, it's not what it claims to be. Colossal Laboratories came out and said they've resurrected dire wolves from extinction, and they, you know, probably want to put it out in the wild. And that's not at all what happened. What they did was they took a gray wolf, an actual real-life gray wolf, took their DNA, put it in CRISPR, the machine that allows for DNA manipulation, and reproduced a copy of the direwolf DNA. Then they took this modified gray wolf DNA and they put it in a dog, and the dog gave birth. And what you have now is sort of a dog-wolf hybrid that looks like a direwolf, but actually isn't a direwolf. And so there are two questions. The first is, if you reproduce something using DNA, is the copy the same thing as what it originally was? And we're actually really familiar with this, because we ask this philosophical question when we watch things like Star Trek. Anytime you have teleportation, right, the way the science fiction mechanism uses works is you go in the teleporter, the computer interprets your code, it sends that code to another teleporter 1,000 miles away, and it reproduces the code and gives you a new body. Is that the same person? In the stories, you have the same consciousness, you have the same memories, but is the material the same material? There's actually a really interesting, long-standing philosophical question called the Ship of Theseus. And Aristotle puts the puzzle in this way. He says, imagine you have a ship and you take a piece of wood off of that ship and put it next to the other ship. And then you take another piece of wood, a plank or whatever, and you put it next to that one, and you take the ship apart, and then you rebuild an exact replica with the same material, but you've taken it apart and rebuilt it. Is it the same ship? We don't know. This has deep metaphysical roots and threads and questions. So again, to summarize, the first question we want to ask is, are these things that we're calling direwolves really direwolves? Is the DNA we're using as duplication the same thing, or is it just a copy of a copy of a copy? Next, what are our moral responsibilities with this new species, right? If we were to actually take a dire wolf and put it into the ecosystem, would it survive? Does the food that it needs still exist? Lots of people know about the paleo diet, and they talk about eating things that only existed in prehistoric times. But the food that we eat now is very genetically different than the food that we ate as Neanderthals or early Homo sapiens. Carrots are completely different. Tomatoes didn't exist in the same form. So we wouldn't be able to digest the food that early human beings ate. Would the dire wolf be able to sustain itself in our current ecosystem, and would it become a predator? Would it become prey? What happens when you put an invasive species into a new environment? So we start off with the identity question, the metaphysical question. We then move to the consequence question, and what are the unforeseen consequences? And then we ask the third question, which is, should we do it? Do we have a moral responsibility to continue or to refrain? The easiest formulation of this question is, are human beings permitted to play God? And how much do we have a right to mess with nature? This itself is a tremendously slippery question, because on the one hand, messing with DNA is a kind of playing God, but so is taking ibuprofen, right? So is putting alcohol on a cut. This is why Christian Scientists believe that medicine is immoral, and that if God wants you to heal, God will heal you. So we all play God in one form or another. How much is too much? What is good about this discussion is that it gets enough people's attention that it allows us to focus on these pivotal philosophical conundrums, so that when it happens again, we've already started thinking about it.
We've beamed in Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein for our monthly Philosophical Currents discussion. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. And we're talking about essentially de-extinction, bringing species back that have been declared extinct or maybe have been extinct for a very long time. What if this has crossed a line? Who's to stop whom? And as you talked about a little bit ago, playing God.
So my favorite response to the question, who's to say this is right or wrong, is me. I'm a philosopher. That's my job. That's what I'm hired to do. But in all honesty, when ethicists say, can I do X, right? Is it okay to murder someone? Is it okay to resurrect species? They're not asking, do I have the free will to do it? They're not saying, is someone going to bind my hands and stop me from doing it? They're asking, should I do it? Is the act morally obligatory? Do I have to use my will and my intellect and my empathy and my sense of judgment and say, I want to do this, but I shouldn't, because it's bad? So the first thing that has to happen is that the scientists have to engage in a lot of self-reflection. They have to talk with their colleagues. They have to hopefully have taken ethics classes when they were getting their PhDs. And they have to be part of a community-wide discussion of experts that take seriously the ethical ramifications of their research. If they're not doing that, they are profoundly negligent. The second set of questions that they have to ask is, how do we balance the ethical obligations with the profit motive, right? The colossal laboratories wants to make money. They want to sell their inventions. They want investors. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make money, and there's nothing wrong with wanting to make profit, but there are certain things that we have decided are not acceptable actions. We don't sell human organs, for example. And perhaps more relevant and interesting, we're actually not allowed to sell zoo animals. Zoos can trade elephant, you know, we have an elephant, we want four otters. We'll give you the elephant for your otters. They can do that. They can do things that help cultivate the well-being of the animals, get them in the right environment, and also keep the zoo going. But there's no marketplace in that sense for animals. So we already have discussions about the moral treatment of animals as commodities, the moral treatment of animals as objects of exchange, what it means to be the advocate and the caretaker for animals. And so the scientists also have to be part and parcel of that conversation. Now, let's ask another question, such as, what is our responsibility to fix the wrongs that we've done in the past? What is our responsibility to repair damage that we may have caused, or, you know, just nature happened, right?
Redemption.
I think redemption is a really good way of thinking about this. Jurassic Park is about the question, if we make up for the destruction of the dinosaurs, are we doing something good or bad? The movie takes an easy way out, because what it basically says is we think we can control nature, but we can't. And so we're going to try to stop the destruction of innocent people, of innocent amusement parks, right? But it never answers the question definitively, should we bring the dinosaurs back from extinction?
Why are we so fascinated with this, Jack?
There is nothing more exciting about creating something from nothing. This is the wonder of art, of music, of painting, of literature, of giving birth, right? You are creating something from nothing. And when you can create something from nothing, you, in theory, can build a world or a universe that you have designed. There are lots of conversations now about whether or not it's moral to say, we're having a kid, we want to manipulate the DNA so that...
Which is happening, apparently.
There's so much to say.
Oh my gosh.
So you're having a kid and you have the possibility to manipulate the DNA. You find out the kid has autism. Is it okay to manipulate the DNA so that the kid doesn't have autism? You find out the kid is deaf. Is it okay to manipulate the DNA so they're not deaf? You find out the kid has small hands and you want them to be a piano player. Is it okay to manipulate the DNA so they have big hands? We can start from questions about the most insidious diseases, the diseases that kids, you know, they're born with their internal organs outside the skin. They live in horrendous pain for 40 minutes and then die, right? We can start with the most extreme versions, work through the spectrum going from things like autism or hearing impairment, and then we're talking about aesthetic choices. And do we want to select people for skin color or hair color or hand sizes and things like that? What's true of one side of the spectrum may not be true of the other. But these are deep questions about not just how to minimize harm and minimize pain, but also where the line is between justice and aesthetics. But there's a very big movement in the deaf community where people who are deaf want to regard being deaf as its own culture, as its own way of being in the world with norms and its own values, much like an ethnicity or something like that. And people from who hold that position are often very angry at the idea that being deaf is something to be fixed. To say being deaf is less than to say someone can hear is a aesthetic value judgment and a moral value judgment that many people in the deaf community find offensive. There's this whole discussion now with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. about autism and how, from his perspective, autism is the most horrible thing in the world and there are no autistic adults left and we need to find the cause of autism and eradicate it the way that we might have eradicated polio or something like that. And first of all, empirically, he's just wrong. There are plenty of autistic adults in the world, and lots of people who have autism lead wonderful, happy, fulfilling, constructive lives. So in that sense, it's just incorrect descriptions of people in their lives. But it's on the table, and we now are having a conversation about what are the moral ramifications and the social and cultural meanings of trying to eradicate a disease. We can extend those conversations to these questions about bringing animals back from extinction and changing our overall ecosystem.
I'm going to give you the direct line to Colossal Laboratories and Biosciences, who on their website, their headline is "Making Extinction a Thing of the Past." As a philosopher, what's your message?
My message is twofold. Stop lying and slow down. That's what I would want them to do. I don't know that it's my place to have a definitive value judgment about what they're doing, in part because I'm not an expert and I don't truly understand it. But I know the truth when I see it, and I know the value of truth over falsity. So stop lying. Admit what you're actually doing so we can have an honest conversation with integrity and authenticity, and slow down so that we can all talk about what you're doing, make suggestions, and guide you to the best of all possible outcomes where we can look back at what we did and be proud and happy that we participated in.
We enjoy our monthly conversations in a segment we call Philosophical Currents with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, the professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. Jack, this is awesome. Thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
Oh, I love this stuff. I love ripped from the headlines conversations, but I also love the questions that force us to take a look at our core values and ask not just who we should be, but are we who we think we really are? Barry and his voice got bass. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep.